Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. LA Network, the filming service from independent filmmaker Robert Riguez, turns 5 years old this December. Where is this venture at and what is ahead? Learn when LA Network president and general manager Daniel Tibbetts joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Lore, one of the first true instant podcasts adapted for scripted television, is back for season 2 of The Amazon. New executive producer Sean Crouch provides details later this hour. And one more season of Orange is the New Black to go. Netflix will bring its award-winning groundbreaker of a dramedy to the finish line next year. Reaction and more next from co-star Rebecca Knox. That's at the top of the next hour. Also ahead, the new TV festival in town, Our Town, Endgame for Filmstruck, and our classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in this program. Happy to have you aboard on this Friday afternoon for the promo about television. 49 degrees at the top of the hour, and boy, do we have a great lineup for you over the next 90 minutes. We're going to get right to it, and that means we want you involved right off the bat. So pick up the phone, raise your voice, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anywhere you'll catch us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Our chat room is open for business. You can find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's SimonApple04 by name, and it's just waiting for you. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Daniel Tibbetts from LA Network, live with us from Los Angeles, after these news notes. Truck up one more television festival for the New York metro area, launching 1 week from today. The New York City Television Festival, that's different from the New York TV Festival, will operate from the Dolby Theater in Midtown Manhattan next Friday and Saturday night. 13 television series pilots will be presented over the next 2 nights, most produced in the United States. One pilot was filmed in Russia, dealing with the Bolshoi Ballet, and another takes place in Iceland. Organizer Roberto Rizzo will be on this program next Friday with more on the event's creation and future plans. For the second time in 2 weeks, WarnerMedia announced a shutdown of a venture supplying content to smart television sets and TV-connected gear. Filmstruck, launched 2 years ago as a supplement to Turner Classic Movies, will expire November 29th. Filmstruck found a loyal, though niche crowd for its subscription mix of overseas, indie, and genre movie titles, and some Hollywood titles, too. Super Deluxe, the Turner unit making comedy series and short subjects, received its termination order last week. Netflix is parting ways with American Vandal, the Peabody-winning true crime satire launched last fall. 2 seasons were produced through Netflix, with the latest episodes premiering 2 months ago. However, CBS Television Studios has made the series, is out to keep Vandal going elsewhere, and has taken a number of inquiries from undisclosed parties. Now some quickies, it's all over for Megyn Kelly today. Her 9 a.m. hour will be hosted by other Today co-anchor people starting Monday morning on NBC. Bob's Order's second animated series for next season, Duncanville, organized by Amy Poehler, The Simpsons producer Mike Scully, and wife Julie. Let This House was the first. And Investigation Discovery will premiere Body Cam November 27th. Episodes make extensive use of micro cameras worn by local police officers. And that's the first for television. And that is news notes for today. And now joining us live from Los Angeles in an interview exclusive, President and General Manager of LA Network, Daniel Tibbetts. Daniel, welcome in.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it and happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure and happy to have you aboard, Daniel. Where is LA at?
Where is LA at? Well, so you said it. We are heading into our 5th anniversary of the network. And it's really been amazing to see what Robert created. He had a very specific vision many years ago, and that was, you know, to create a Latino-infused media brand and make it, because he wanted a place for Latinos to be seen and heard and to showcase their creativity. I really look at what we've done over these last 5 years. I've been here for the last 2.5. And, you know, I think we've really delivered on that in a lot of different ways.
What's the most important way, Daniel, that you have delivered with this network?
Well, so let's go back to that philosophy, right, that Robert Rodriguez has had for really 25 years, right? When you look at his films, they have really crossed into the global marketplace. It's about total audience, but it's always been about representing Latinos in a positive light, When you think about Spy Kids, right, one of his iconic films, and the idea that that was a Hispanic family, right? But it was a total market. Everybody went and saw it. Everybody could relate, being a kid saying, hey, how cool would it be if my family were spies? And he took that entire philosophy of his film career and he brought it into the network. And before I get into some of the programming that we've delivered on, you know, why? Why is that important? You know, and well, we are an escapist television English language network. You know, part of the idea is the mission behind it, and it's because, you know, when you see yourself reflected on TV, and it makes you realize you're not alone. You know, he didn't start El Rey for himself. He did it for the next generation, the generation that hasn't always seen themselves portrayed in a positive light. And we see it, by the way, when you look back at television today, the 80s, the 90s, and even the early 2000s. The Latino, the U.S. Hispanic population isn't always reflected in a positive light. And so Robert wanted a place to create content that did exactly that. And by the way, you know, from a just pure demographic standpoint, you know, the largest growing population in America today is the Latino population, especially young people. And so by giving them a place for their stories to be heard, you know, I don't know of any other place that is better suited or doing that the way we are doing it here at El Rey. And if you want, like, you know, look, some of the things that we've done, I think, really well are our signature tentpole program, Lucha Underground. Lucha Underground is a great example of taking AAA wrestling, right, in Mexico and bringing it to the U.S. and redeveloping it in a very big fantasy, escapist entertainment format. But holding true, you know, to the history, to the foundation, to the culture in which it comes from. And we've done that successfully. Now we're in our fourth season. We actually are fourth season is wrapping up, you know, in a few weeks. So we've managed to show that crossover of developing, creating programming that is very unique but appeals to a mass audience. It's something you've actually heard me say in the past, something I love about programming today, which is the mass niche. It's a very specific point of view. It's a very specific programming or group audience you're talking to, but there's a lot of them. And being able to provide programming to that audience, That's what I love doing the best. And I think that's what Robert has done so incredibly successful.
When El Rey started, one of the things that Robert was dead set on was to try to develop scripted series that would feature new Latino talent on both sides of the camera, as writers and directors, as well as actors. There was From Dusk to Dawn, the television version of one of his most popular movies. There was Matador, which ran a year. I think Dustin ran three seasons. Matador ran a year. We had, by the way, executive producers from both series on this program during their runs.
But in recent years,
though, the scripted series has taken sort of a backseat to other ways that you are showcasing new talent. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, what we've done is set a mission to put even more programming on air. So as you know, scripted programming is expensive, right? And that doesn't mean we're not going to be doing scripted programming. Matter of fact, definitely look for us to continue to do scripted programming in the future. But one of the things when I came into the network and I looked at the amount of content being produced, for me, and coming from digital, right, my career is half in television and then half in digital. So I have a lot of interesting or unique production finance, production models in which to do scripted and non-scripted. So my goal was simple. How do I take Robert's mission and blow it up, make it bigger, right? Do more of that type of content. And we did that. We actually, over these last 2 years, we've managed to double our originals in prime time. And once we've created that foundation, right, then it's now what else and how do you build on top of that? And the truth is, you know, that is a typical evolution of cable networks, finding the footing, creating the brand, creating a lot of content, you know, primarily non-scripted to get that foundation and then being to build scripted on top of it. El Rey did something very unique, as you pointed out. They came out of the gate and said, no, we're going to go and do scripted programming on day one. And that was fantastic. And by the way, From Dusk Till Dawn, the series, it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. How do we do more and more? That's the objective.
And in a moment, we're going to talk to Daniel about how they are doing more and more with both scripted and also some very unique, aside from Lucha Underground, there's another very unique unscripted from here too that we'll get to shortly. You're hearing Daniel Tibbetts. He's the president and general manager of El Rey Network, which this December marks 5 years on the air in millions of households on cable and satellite across the country. And he's with us live from Los Angeles this half hour. On 90 minutes, tomorrow will be televised to wrap up your week. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Give a question or comment for Daniel. Don't be shy. Make the call, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. It's just waiting for you. We have another night of edition to wrap up October on Monday, and we're going to kick it off with the former head of CNN, John Klein. You know that artificial intelligence is becoming more and more a part of your television set or your smart TV device like Amazon Fire TV or Google Chromecast? Well, we'll get John's comments about how it will be, and he's formed a new TV venture to help TV stations and other parties make the most of AI. John Klein will be with us, our lead guest. Also on the program, we'll speak to a veteran observer of television named David Tice. He's got a brand new book out called The Golden Box. And one of our favorite guests in the world of journalism will join us as well. The senior digital media correspondent in CNNnews.com, New York, Joan Sullivan will be join us. We'll talk about what Apple may or may not say about Apple TV next Tuesday at the Brooklyn Academy of Music here in New York. We'll also get her thoughts about what Jennifer Salke, that is Amazon Studios, said here in New York at the 1975 Great Fast Company Interactive and Innovation Festival all week long, taking place there and at Convene. So Joan Sullivan from CNNews.com, along with John Klein, along with David Tice, as all Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. So, Jen, you have a couple of unscripted shows that are now running. Well, actually, there's one that is running now and one about to run. And one of the ones that is running is one featuring a very popular talent, Danny Trejo.
Yes. First off, I love the lineup you just announced. Jennifer Salke, wonderful. Really talented. Can't wait to hear all of those interviews. But back to El Rey. So Man-at-Arms, Art of War. So we are in season two of this program. And here's a great example, by the way, of a program that very successful in digital on YouTube with Defy Media. And you know, fits our tone, our style, kind of the historical perspective of weapon making, the technology behind it. Why was this important? What was the process utilized at the time? But taking someone like Danny Trejo, right, Machete, right, himself, and bringing him to be a part of the program, redeveloping it into an hour format where we really kind of hone in and focus even deeper into the historical perspective of, you know, the technology of why these weapons changed the course of history, you know. And so it's a program that, is a great example of the movement of digital to traditional linear television and how to do that from a creative standpoint. But also, you know, they're two very different shows. One is very Defy Media from a brand and content and production standpoint. The other is very cinematic and big and bold, how, you know, almost like how Robert would look at one of his features when we bring in our weapon testers, all of which, by the way, are, you know, professional stunt people and actors who are experts at these weapons to come in and actually show how they were utilized, you know, and why they were so important to the course of history. So, yes, matter of fact, we have, if I can do a quick plug, Wednesday we have our Lucha Underground, followed by Man at Arms. So definitely a great night on El Rey to be at, especially on Halloween, where we're going to have Ultima Lucha Part 1, and then we're actually premiering a new series called Day 5. So the other series, if I may, that is coming up really soon is on November 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time is Rebel Without a Crew. And I know everyone listening right now is going to be unbelievably excited about this series because Robert started his career, as everybody knows, by directing a $7,000 film. And that film went on to be, well, it was El Mariachi and very successful, and that, you know, launched his career. Well, when Robert and I first sat down, he wanted to celebrate the 25th anniversary of El Mariachi, of what he did, by seeing if he still had what it takes and do it again, and invite five filmmakers to Austin to shoot brand new features on a $7,000 budget. And the series is a documentation of what they experienced. And, you know, our filmmakers, we did a casting search. We had thousands of people submit, I mean, within a week. Filmmakers from all walks of life who had aspirations of doing what Robert did. Maybe they've created shorts. Maybe they've, you know, written a script and didn't know how to get started. But what we did is invite them in to have Robert mentor them and accomplish, you know, something unbelievable, which is a $7,000 film. So that's another program that I think well represents the vision that Robert had created those 5 years ago. Another one that we're really proud of is what we do today with Baja Desert Championship. It's in its second year on El Rey. Now, here's a great example of a program. It's the Baja 1000. It's the Baja 500. And historically, that program on CBS, right, it's a very different show. It's about the race. Right, it's about the guys who go there, and ultimately they're set out to drive 500 miles and win, right, or 1,000 miles. What we saw was a place and the people that live there that represent that, a very different perspective in how it is shot. It's very cinematic viewpoint of the action that's occurring, but also the people that are there. And so you can see, that's a great example of, you can see the vision and the point of view that we have as El Rey Network, you know, from a casting standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, from a cinematic view standpoint, and why we do certain things with our network. Can I tell you about one other program that we've been doing over the last couple of years that I'm really excited about?
Sure.
Okay. So the People's Network Showcase. Here's another great example. I said earlier that Robert created this network, right, because he wanted a place for Latinos to be seen and heard, right, to showcase their creativity. And so when I joined the company, the very first thing I greenlit was a vision Robert had. He always called El Rey the People's Network. It was the People's Network because he wanted it to be that platform. You got to remember, 25 years ago when he started, right, as a young Latino filmmaker, there was no outlet, there was no place, right, where he could show his work. But he wanted that place. So we created a show called the People's Network Showcase, where we give an opportunity to our viewers, right? We give them a chance to contribute to El Rey's on air. And that could be short films. It could be promos. And we've had so much great work submitted to us by young, diverse filmmakers. And we turned that into a show. And so we get a submission of a lot of short films, maybe in an action genre or an animation genre or a suspense genre. And then we pick, you know, 10 or 15 of them. And then we fly those filmmakers from wherever they are to our studio, where they get to sit in the director's chair, very much like Robert's very own show, The Director's Chair, and they get to be front and center and tell their story, just like Robert has told his story for so many years. And the results are unbelievable. Those young filmmakers have gone on to get agents. They've gone on to get jobs. They've gone on to get financing for feature-length films. And it just goes to show that someone like Robert and dedicating and saying, no, this is important, this is what we're going to do, and then you see the results come out of it, and you see people who say, wow, there's nowhere else, there's nobody else who does this, right? It's El Rey. That means something. And that's, you know, look, I wear my, and look, I know I'm here preaching about El Rey and the benefits of it, but it's important. It's not just a cable network. It's not just about, we're airing cool programming, right? There's plenty of networks that air cool programming. We also have a mission behind it. And that's super important. Matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but there's 10 major Latino organizations in this country that stand behind and helped Robert get El Rey on the air. NCLR, the League of Latin American Citizens, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, these organizations and more were a critical part of getting in front of Congress, getting in front of Comcast and saying this is needed. So for 5 years, we do stand behind and are here to represent why we were created in the first place. And we do it by entertaining mass audiences.
Daniel, I think we have a call. We're going to take it. Hello, you're on Tomorrow We Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from? Hello, you're on the air. I was even going to try to get that person on. Hold on 1 second. Let's try it again. Hello, you're on Tomorrow We Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from? All right, that person dropped off, so if you want to call back, 646-652-2906, please do so, and we'll get you back on the air. What does it look like for 2019? Can you tell us any new shows that are coming up? And you mentioned earlier the scripted is going to come back in some fashion. Any thoughts about when and in what form?
Yeah, so we are in that process actually right now. What is our 2019 lineup? And one of the big things is obviously continued growth. We are planning to double our programming, which by the way, anyone who knows how time consuming or how hard it is to create original content, we're going to do more. And that's always been my mandate. It's always been Robert's mandate about, hey, if we can't find this type of programming, if we can't find content that is representing U.S. Hispanic population, Latinos in America in a positive light, then it's we have to make more of it. So, it's more originals that define that voice, like Lucha, like Man at Arms, that really perform to the diverse audience. The other thing I would say, and we've actually started doing this now, and you're going to see us do it more in 2019, is stop and recognize and feature a lot of the things that El Rey has been doing over the last 5 years. So we launched a campaign called Hashtag Our Story. And Hashtag Our Story is about celebrating our five-year anniversary. And so we set out to capture a series of videos featuring friends and families of the network. Matter of fact, you mentioned interviewing some of the directors or executive producers of Matador from Dusk Till Dawn, but Bob Orsi, right? Let's hear from Bob Orsi and talk to Bob Orsi about, you know, what El Rey has meant, or Wilmer Valderrama, right, from Dusk Till Dawn, who also is a part of it, but also some of the contributors that I mentioned earlier, like Felix Sanchez, who's the co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts, Maria Cardona, who is a CNN contributor. These people, these voices, these faces are the ones who have made El Rey successful. And so what you're going to see and should see in watching El Rey is a lot of interstitials, a lot of what, you know, we call bumpers that talk about what we're doing, talking about our programming going forward. So really setting up the stage so that our audience and maybe some people who aren't currently watching El Rey are informed about all the work we're doing. But I think over the next couple of months, you're going to hear a lot of great news coming out of Elway. You're going to hear a lot about it, some original programming that we're going to start programming really at Q1 of 2019.
Two questions more that you know, Daniel. One is, we now have this circuit of television festivals that are going on around the country. The bunch that are here in New York and Cleveland, we just announced it near the top of the show, is the brand new New York City Television Festival. They're happening next weekend. We'll have the original of that festival on our show next Friday. You have Series Fest in Denver. You have festivals in Chicago, Atlanta, Austin, Texas, not far from where Robert has his headquarters. Have you thought about either you or Robert or other people from Elray attending some of these TV festivals to see if you can scope out talent that might work for you and your network?
Well, we do that constantly. We do that all the time. We are at these festivals. We are meeting with the organizers. We are looking at new content, new creators constantly, because that's the voice, right? That's we want to make sure that we're cultivating. You know, one of the things that's always been said about the network, right? Having someone like Robert as the head of your network and somebody that creative is a dream come true, because it's very clear who we are and what our brand is. That's the one thing you can say is people go, I know that brand. And so he also talks about his creative collective, and his creative collective are individuals that he has found and said, wow, that's the next Robert Rodriguez, or that's the, you know, next Michelle Rodriguez or whatever. Right. And we search out and we thought, matter of fact, greatest example, again, Rebel Without a Crew. When I look at the filmmakers that we just worked with, Scarlett Marino, Alejandro Montoya Martin, Bola, we look at these filmmakers now and we go, OK, you're ready. You're ready to take the reins. And how can we help you now get to the next step of your career? So finding that at festivals, finding that through the People's Network Showcase, finding that through shows like Rebel Without a Crew, that is a huge priority.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is we're now about to see programs and plumbing services using blockchain and cryptocurrency to create and fund and distribute their work. Any possibility of, let's say, taking shows that are crowdfunded or shows that use blockchain or cryptocurrency to get themselves launched through your network? And the other question I had was, and this is why I was thrilled to have you on today, is because when Elray started, Robert Rodriguez was so in public about it. He did an event here in New York with press, which I was at. He was featured in Univision's, Univision, which was an investor in the network, in their upfronts. The last couple of years, it's sort of been not as much, and I know that we have so many programming services now more than ever before, but I'm wondering if we're going to see more public appearances by Robert on behalf of the network, and was yourself, and more interaction with the press, more interaction with the public to let folks know, hey, Elray, 5 years, and now we're going into the next five with some super things.
So two great questions. Let me start with the cryptocurrency. So one, again, as you know, the entertainment business, if we can find ways to co-fund, create more content and do that economically, and if that's a means to do it, then absolutely. I've actually seen a couple models that I find fascinating, one of which is a group that is using cryptocurrency as a way to create individual film projects so that the those involved, your executive producer, your director, et cetera, they have a stake in the success of the product, and it's generated or, I guess, monitored or controlled via individual funds, which if in the entertainment business for, you know, as long as I remember, the idea of back end or profit participation or upside sometimes gets convoluted in the studio financial systems. I think cryptocurrency allows creators to get paid, right, to benefit from their work in a very more transparent method. And so that's one way that I think crypto is going to be beneficial to the entertainment overall. So that's that. The second is, first, two things. One is, you very specifically stated that, will we see more of an outward presence from Robert? And the answer is, I would start with, Robert is 100% involved in this network on a day-to-day basis. Believe it or not, we have a chairman, a founder, a head of creative that is so involved. He'll still look at every promo. He'll still have conversations about creative development. He wants to be engaged at a very deep level because this is important to him. It is a major priority. It was a very clear vision that he has built that we are charged executing. So his involvement has not wavered in the least. As far as public appearance, it's a great point. Robert is still out there publicly, actually. We just launched something as simple as, hey, get out and vote, right? Which Robert is featured in and very passionate about people voting, right? Get out and vote. Also, when you look at what we're doing around our story, Robert's front and center. He's actually the front and center element of saying, hey, this is what we're doing and why we're doing it. When you look at events, he was just at New York Comic Con. He was just at an event in San Diego. So I would say that he is out there. He is very passionate about the network. And you know what? The answer is we'll do more. We'll do more of that because we need to spread the word about what El Rey is. We need people to understand that it has, again, escapist entertainment that is for everyone, but also has a very clear mission for its existence, and therefore we need to continue to grow the brand overall.
And we should point out that why we're able to do this interview live today is because you were at the Future of Television Forum at the Museum of Jewish Heritage here in New York about a month ago, and we had a chance to meet, and I'm thrilled you were able to take the invitation to come on. So we really appreciate that. El Rey Network, yes. It's available on cable and satellites in millions of households all over the country, so check your locals for where you can find that network, which will mark 5 years on the air this December. And for more details about the network online, www.elraynetwork.com. That's www.elraynetwork.com. Turning five and going for more this December. Daniel Curtis, the President, General Manager of El Rey, thank you for being on. Congratulations to you, Robert, everybody involved for coming into the fifth anniversary and hopefully the start of many, many more things to come. And we'd love to have both you and Robert back on anytime you like.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
You're welcome, Daniel. All the greatest. Have a super weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Daniel Tibbetts, the President and General Manager of El Rey, joining us live from Los Angeles. When we come back, Lore is in its second season on Amazon, and we'll meet the new executive producer who's guiding it, Sean Crouch. He's also with us live from L.A., and we'll get to him after we pause after the bottom of the hour, for web identification. You listen to the best student radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com and Spreaker.com, together reaching over 30 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for the Real Don Smith Show. Check out Don and guests tomorrow, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, that's featured 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Tomorrow Be Televised on this Friday afternoon of October 2018. Simon Appleman with you live from New York. If you have questions or comments for our guests ahead in the hour ahead, give us a ring, 646-652-2906. No good, good anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the world, on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. And there's also our chat room available, SimonApple04 by name. You can use it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Over a year ago, Lore became one of the first podcasts to get translated into dramatic television through Amazon Studios, and most recently, it is back for a second season. My next guest is the new executive producer on the block for Lore. You may know him from his work on Veronica Mars, Numbers, and more recently, the second and final season, a Fox acclaimed version of The Exorcist. Joining us live from Los Angeles, Sean Krause. Hello, Sean.
Hey, Simon. Thanks for having me, man.
It is a pleasure. How is Laura Season 2 doing?
Fantastic. I'm really, really happy. I'm really happy with the fan response. I'm really happy with the critical response. It's doing what I hoped it would do.
Which is what?
Which is, grow the show. I like to evolve a show, from season to season. And I think, I think on Exorcist we took it in a different direction. Not too much of a different direction. Lore, we took in a bigger, different direction, but I think we've evolved it from, the podcast roots to now its own thing that I think you can watch in tandem with each other, and they won't sort of copy the same information. which has always been the intention, to leave the podcast as its own thing and the show as its own thing. And I think there was, in season one, I think there was some crossover there.
And that first season of Lore, which people enjoy, which is why it's back for season two, is that it's focused in a documentary style on its subject matter, which are true incidents in anthology format. And in the second season, the documentary style feel and camera work and tone has been sort of toned down to be more cinematic, more story-like, more, let's be more visual. Fair assessment?
Absolutely correct. That's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to give not the same tonnage of information, because we can't, you know, we can't do that without completely going into the documentary format. But we still are a true story. We still are in the unscripted department at Amazon. So that's what we're still trying to get that across. But now we're trying to keep it very integrated into the pieces where you don't notice it. You know, in our first episode, we use sort of chyrons, stylized chyrons, and we use Punch and Judy show that our characters actually interact with, and we actually get some nice emotion from that. You know, in the second episode, we go back to more what they did in the first season with some animation. The third episode, all the documentary stuff is actually more going back to my procedural, my numbers roots. You know, it's a procedural type way where we have the detectives sort of going through this unsolved mystery, walking us through all the different pieces rather than cutting away to, you know, documentary pieces of it. In our fourth episode, we have The Curse of the Prague Clock. You know, we filmed all the backstory in that one rather than, we were talking about doing it animated, doing it documentary style, but since it's the 1400s, you know, there's not any archival footage, so we went that way with it. Our fifth episode, we use a lot of voiceover and we use some animation. And then our sixth episode is the closest to what we did in season one, where it's archival footage and documentary, and you learn a lot about JPL and Aleister Crowley and all these different things. But it's all within the mind of a man who's dying. And so he's an unreliable narrator, and it's a much sort of an artistic way of doing the documentary stuff. It's funny, I've seen reviews of people saying, I really liked episode six, but I don't think it was very accurate. And that's very true. I mean, the character actually says in the piece a couple times, you know what, I'm lying to you right now, but I wish she was with me. So I'm going to put her right with me right now.
I was interviewing Tamara Tooney, the former co-star of Lunar Special Victims Unit, who just completed work on a Netflix series coming out. It's on the BBC now, but will be in January on Netflix, called Black Earth Rising. And they use animation to help introduce scenes or come out of scenes. That's a very unusual thing for a scripted series to do. In your case, when you have all these different formats you're juggling, animation, Punch and Judy puppetry, live action, documentary, scripted, backstory, being inside an episode where it's all inside, or mostly inside the mind of somebody. How do you, as an executive producer, sort of juggle the different production techniques? How do you figure this will work greater with this story than another story? What sort of inspires you to go in particular routes in particular episodes?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, how do we do it? I surround myself with geniuses, and then I take credit for what they come up with. So our writing staff in season one was fantastic. Season two, I was not part of the show. Season two, our writing staff was fantastic. Then we got two just fantastic directors. We have Alice Troughton, who did the first, third, and fifth episodes, and then Christoph Schreiber, who did two, four, and six. They basically alternated, and they came up with a lot of these ideas. You know, in the writers' room, we sort of broke to the animation, and we broke towards the Punch and Judy, but then you get the visual style that these directors bring in their ideas, and it sort of all evolves into the final product that you can see on Amazon right now. What was the second part of your question?
Well, when you're dealing with this in an anthology format, as opposed to, you know,
right,
the numbers, you had a certain structure of how to do the show. In Veronica Mars,
yeah,
a certain, so even The Exorcist, you had to be having your characters go through in each episode toward a conclusion. How do you like the idea of mixing up techniques in specific episodes, given the anthology nature of this?
Well, in the very basic side of things. You know, I was on my very first job, I was taught that every season has a, you know, beginning, middle, and end, but every episode has a beginning, middle, and end, and every act has a beginning, middle, and end, and that means every scene has a beginning, middle, and end. So from a very simplistic standpoint, the, you know, each anthology has a beginning, middle, and an end that we can follow through. And then we just, we attacked it this season like we were doing an episode of Black Mirror or an episode of Twilight Zone, you know, six different mini movies that told a very simple story on hopefully an epic scale with the money that Amazon gave us. From a production point of view, it's very difficult doing an anthology show. I've never done one before, and it's very hard to make six sort of mini movies in the time frame of a TV series. You know, on Exorcist, we had our house, we had our actors, you know, we had our island, and we had it for 10 episodes. And so we didn't have to worry about casting for the most part, or wardrobe, or changing locations. And in an anthology show, you do have to jump around from location to location to location. Luckily, we were in Prague, and five of our six episodes we were able to find locations for, including 1680 Salem, Massachusetts, or Hadley, Massachusetts, near Salem, and, you know, 1952 Pasadena we found in Prague. Ironically, our one episode that took place in Prague at the Prague Clock, we had to shoot on the stages because the clock is being repaired right now.
You're hearing Sean Crouch. He is the new executive producer of Lore, whose second six-episode season is now running on Amazon, which is available on most smart TV sets and smart devices, including Amazon Fire TV, which you can get either as an operating system to your television set or a streaming stick or plug-in. Sean joins us live in Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon, have fun with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment for Sean, don't be shy. Make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next Friday on Tomorrow We Televise, my lead guest will be Charlie Hatel. He's one of the executive producers of a big special coming next Sunday night at ABC, celebrating the 90th birthday of none other than Mickey Mouse. It's Mickey's 90th Spectacular, and Charlie will be with us as our lead guest. Then we will have people behind a brand new series on Bravo called Buying It Blind, where six couples have the opportunity to purchase a home without setting foot in it. And we'll have the three people who will make the calls for them. They'll all be with us, and we hope to have one of the executive producers, too. And finally, as noted earlier, we'll have Roberto Rizzo. He is the organizer of the brand-new New York City Television Festival that premieres 1 week from tonight at the Dolby Theater in Midtown Manhattan. That's all coming up next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. Sean, all your experiences to this point, Veronica Mars, Numbers, Exorcist, how do they all blend in to taking on Lore, which, as you mentioned, is your first time doing an anthology, and also your first time doing a podcast adaptation?
You know, I go all the way back to writing jokes for Bette Midler. I wanted to be a comedy writer back in the day. I didn't enjoy the lifestyle, and I went into the drama world where I found it more satisfying, the writing. But even going back to comedy, and then to, you know, to the procedural, the science of Numbers. I mean, Numbers I used when I wrote the Jack Parsons episode, because he created JPL, basically, one of the rocket scientists that started NASA back in the day. And that was, you know, that was a story I heard about when we were shooting at Caltech on Numbers. And so that's always sat back in my head. Working on Veronica Mars, I read about the Hinterkaifeck murders, you know, which is the German murders that we used this year. So a lot of my research that I've done for other shows that I've been on, I've actually then taken and used on Lore in this anthology. The only story I didn't know anything about, which was the Prague Clock story. So everything else, the other five stories, have come through at some point in my career, including on, you know, in Helix and Dominion, these science fiction shows, again, gave me a way to say, okay, this is how I take a genre, you know, here's a genre, but starting on a show like Veronica Mars, which is the real world, or Numbers, which is real world, it gives you sort of the basics, the background to write genre. And I'm a huge genre fan. I'm a huge horror and science fiction fan, but I'm always trying to come at that. Like Exorcist, to me, was a family show. It's about a foster father who lost his wife, and he's got five kids to take care of. And then, you know, once we set that stage, we drop a demon into it. I think it's I'm reading a lot of reviews. I haven't seen Haunting on Hill House yet, but I'm reading a lot of reviews that it's This Is Us with ghosts. And that's what genre, I think that's what, when genre works the best for me, is when it's This Is Us, but with ghosts. And so that's what we tried to do on Lore this season, is what is the real human stories at the very heart of each of these six episodes, and then extrapolate and find the supernatural, find the genre coming from that, especially being based on true stories.
And when you're dealing with podcasts, you're also dealing with the people who create the podcast. What's been your relationship like with the creators of Lore, and what kind of input did they have in terms of bringing both their vision and your vision together?
From the very first day, Aaron Mankey and I have been working hand in hand on this show. He was in the writer's room for the first week with us as we were picking stories. As we decided, we all decided together how to move the format and shake up the format a little bit and make it a little bit more Black Mirror and a little bit less History Channel, for season two. Aaron, along the way, and you see on Twitter, he's been a huge champion of the show and a huge champion of changing the format, because the podcast exists. You can always listen to the podcast, and it's brilliant, and it's probably the number one podcast in the world, or very close to it. But then on the TV show, so we have a weekly call with Aaron. I've gone and done press with him in New York, in Salem. He was out in Prague for the shooting. He was out for production. He's actually in one of the episodes. I now count him as one of my friends on a personal level. So if there's if there's a season three, if we're successful enough, Aaron will be back in the room with us and breaking story again on our new season and how we're going to evolve it from season two to season three.
It seems like podcasts have become the new go-to source for particularly scripted television series. You even have podcast companies like Gimlet Media forming their own divisions to create shows for television. What do you think about this idea of a podcast movement where it's a go-to source for programming?
Yeah, it's an interesting new IP. When I first started in the industry, it was you go to Condé Nast and you get a magazine article and you create a show from that, or at least you attach it, because it's a lot easier sometimes to sell a show if there's a piece of intellectual property attached. It's interesting that podcasts are the new – there was a show on Netflix that debuted the same day we did called Haunted, which is also from a podcast, I believe. And I keep seeing more and more. Now, here's where I'm going to let you down. I am not a podcast guy. I'm an audiobooks guy. I need to hear my audiobook. So I am just now getting into this wide world of podcasts, and there is everything out there. It's amazing. So I can see why it's got this great opening for intellectual property.
But here's something interesting. Jennifer Salke, the head of Amazon Studios, was here in New York at the Fast Company Innovation Festival on Tuesday, and I had a chance to hear her front row. And the thing that struck me about her talk was that down the stretch she said, I really want to now start working with other Amazon divisions. I want to work with the Audible people, by the way, point of disclosure, Audible is our sponsor, with their audiobooks for source material. I want to work with the authors on Amazon books for Amazon material. I want to work with other divisions of Amazon in merchandise and see if we can bring, some of that into the intellectual property of our programming. So it sounds like Jennifer is now in this point where now since she settled in to Amazon Studios, she wants to move TV and film, bring every aspect of Amazon as much as possible into her work.
Yes, please. Please. Please make that happen. I remember when I went in for my first meeting and I sat down and, I started talking about IMDb. And I said, oh, yeah, we own that. And then I started talking about Audible, because that's where I get, obviously, all of my – I go through two audiobooks a week from Audible. They said, we own that. So they have the ability, and then all the authors they have, and all the self-published authors who are now becoming huge names because their books are so good. And Amazon has a lot of that, IP as well. I think it's a great idea for them to be more – synergistic, I guess would be the word, within the company. And not just because my Audible account, I've used up all my free credits.
Lore is now in its second 6-episode season on Amazon, and if you have a smart TV set or a smart TV device like an Amazon Fire TV or Google Chromecast, Roku, with any of those other ones, you can probably get Lore anytime you like. We have Shawna Crouch. She's the new executive producer of the series and is available live from Los Angeles this half hour to us right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Apple going to be live from New York. Delighted to have the wisdom this Friday afternoon. 49 degrees at the top of the hour here in the Big Apple. If you have a question or comment for Shawna in our remaining moments, make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. And coming up in our next half hour, we've got, in addition to our classic trivia question of the week, we will have live from here in New York one of the new co-stars of Orange is the New Black, Rebecca Knox. That series, of course, will be going to its final season on Netflix next year. And Rebecca won raves for her performance. Sean, jump in here, because you really like what she did this year.
I did. I think it was season six. I think it's the best season so far. It was the most tense season, and no spoilers, but I was on edge by episode 10, whatever the last episode was, by halfway through episode 10. And a big part of that was Miss Knox. Her character brought so much tension. I mean, I was so worried that she was going to get, you know, 30 more days or 2 more years on Piper's. That's how into it I was. Her character was brilliant. I think it's a Southie accent. Maybe I'm a West Coast guy, so I don't know Boston that well, but I loved her character, and I went, and it was, her performance was so great because you go back and forth. I went back and forth to hating her character and then to feeling so bad for her and then liking her again. And then she would do something horrendous and I would hate her again. But then, you know, Miss Knox brought it back to this character that I could still, by the end, even by the end of episode 10, I felt so terrible for her and hated her and loved her all together. So I probably spoiled too much of the show there, but it's fantastic season. This is my favorite season so far.
And again, Rebecca is coming on after the top of the hour. You mentioned earlier, Sean, you worked on Helix, and way back when, I was a big fan of the show, we had the creator of the program, someone who had a fascinating backstory because he had never done television. He had worked for the World Bank. Television was not in his ballpark. Then he had an incident happen in the Middle East. That changed his whole thinking. And voila, Helix gets on the air, and he becomes one of the new darlings of the media. I'm curious what it was like to work with him and to work with that program because it had a very claustrophobic feeling to it.
I loved Helix. It was because it was coming in to do basically The Thing, you know, how Sony recruited me in to do it. So I came in about halfway through season one, early on. I mean, we were shooting, I think, episode two. So I wasn't there for the initial, you know, three months of just breaking the story. But I came in sort of midway through, and part of that was to help Cameron, who was great. You know, he had never worked in TV before. So there's a lot of minds. I mean, it's a minefield. If you don't know, you know, where your bread is buttered or what political games to play. And I hate the politics of it, but you know, you have executives that you have to deal with. And on a show like that, you had Ron Moore, who was off doing Outlander by that point. And then you have other Linda Opes, you have other big name producers, you have executives. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of danger in a place like that. And I thought he did very well. And I was only on season one, but I really enjoyed it. It was a really fun show to write because we were allowed to take a lot of risks. And that's always a gift when executives allow you to do that.
When I saw the show in its run, it ran two seasons on Sci-Fi, what really impressed me was two things. One, it had the actors, I thought, the acting was marvelous, top to bottom, and it had this very claustrophobic feeling. And I bring this up because yesterday in Metro, which is one of the local newspapers here in New York, you were interviewed, and you mentioned that one of your favorite things in your life was seeing Alien and how much that film and the way that film evolved made an impact on you. And in watching particularly the first season of Helix, there was an alien type feel to the program. There was an alien type feel to the way the actors were getting their roles, and it was very. And even Cameron mentions, Cameron, of course, the creator. It was very claustrophobic. Like nobody left this complex, which would be getting as the action progressed. Each episode was getting tighter and tighter, more suspenseful, more horrific with every episode.
Yes, And that was absolutely on purpose. You hit it right on the head. It was Alien meets The Thing is that feeling we were going for two reasons. One, because I think that's a great idea. That to me is grand horror. But two, it was a lower budget show. And so we shot entirely on stages. We never went outside, except for the very end of season one. We went outside to Montreal to get a little Paris feel. That was it. Every other scene, at least in season one, every other scene was indoors. And so this is the huge, you know, Arctic expanse that was all on a stage. So when you're on a stage like that, and we had to do the same thing for the Prague Clock episode of Lore. And we decided to go for the Prague Clock episode. We decided to go full on Hellraiser, claustrophobia, man versus machine, and that same feeling. And so that's how I write. I just steal from the movies I love. So, you know, Lore, each episode of Lore has a different sort of movie feel as I pitch it out. For my episode, the Jack Parsons episode, I tell everyone it's Casablanca meets Jacob's Ladder. Is what that is. So on Helix, to say that it started as Alien, you know, Alien and The Thing, I think is right on. And then by the end of the season, it sort of evolves because, again, I loved how Alien, then James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd took it over and it became Aliens. And to me, I love both movies. To me, I actually love Aliens more probably because it has that another mix of genre there where you get that cool claustrophobia that you want from Alien, but then it you know, comes out into this action movie with Sigourney Weaver, and she's my action hero. She's my favorite action hero because of those movies.
By the way, I also love the use of music in that first season, especially that that opening theme with the small title, where it has that little jazzy theme with the middle of the horror. Here's a little bit of jazz in the thing. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
Before I let you go.
Oh, I love it. I love the girl from Ipanema in the
yes.
girl from Ipanema in the elevator during the violence of the elevator. Stever when the zombies are attacking. It was great. And that's a lot of that was Ed Dechter, who as a consultant at the end too, and put in a lot of that music, that jazzy. Mm-hmm. That's great. I loved it too. Thank you for pointing that out.
You're very welcome. So if you continue with Lore into a third season, what would you like to do? And pick a story you'd like that you couldn't do this year that you'd like to second year, or you want to do a certain you want to veer it off into another direction?
No, you know what? There are a lot of stories we wanted to do this year that we couldn't do. And then there's some other sort of tangential stories. Like I did the Jack Parsons episode with Aleister Crowley. To me, Aleister Crowley deserves an episode of his own, you know, the wickedest man in the world, who everyone's basically called him a Satanist, but he really just started his own religion, you know, at the same time that L. Ron Hubbard was starting his religion with the same guy. Jack Parsons was at the center of both of Scientology and Thelema, you know? And so I think that deserves an episode of its own. And then, you know, going back to folklore roots, I would love to see more cultures represented. I thought your interview with Daniel earlier was fantastic because I have a lot of our writing staff. We have the same feeling that we also need to do stories for everybody, so everybody has a story. For instance, you know, one of my writers, Carlos Foglia, who's from Argentina, and he's a recent immigrant to the United States. So he did a story about two Irish immigrants in Scotland, but using a lot of his own, you know, immigrant background and Hispanic background, even though it was about these two Irish guys in the 1820s. And so that's a really important thing. So I love what El Rey is doing, finding those writers, finding those storytellers so we can tell their story. So that's what I want to do in season three, is I want to open it up to more of the, again, we'll always have the Northern European folklore because that's a lot of what our civilization came from. But I want to get into the Mexican America folklore and African folklore and Asian folklore. I think there's a lot of really cool ways to make this even more of a global show.
Lore, season two. Check it out right now on Amazon, on your smart TV set or smart TV device. And for more details about the program online, go to studios.amazon.com. It's studios.amazon.com. Lore, second season of this popular podcast adaptation anthology format, now available on Amazon, smart TV sets, and smart TV devices. Sean Kraft, the executive producer, thank you again for joining us. A pleasure having this last half hour. Congratulations on season two, and hopefully many more seasons to come, and continued success with your TV career. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks a lot, Simon. I really appreciate it. Have a good one, man.
Yep. You too. All the greatest. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Sean Kraft of Lore joining us live from Los Angeles. More tomorrow, we'll be televised, but first some fine words from folks at Audible.com. Have you heard what Audible has been up to lately? How about original audio productions under the banner Audible Theater? Everything from one woman, one man shows to original off-Broadway and Broadway adaptations to original first-run audio productions you can only find at Audible.com. And right now, it's available to you. How? Well, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. Over 8,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them, including all the original audio Audible Theater productions, on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now, at Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and speaker. So start it up at audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. Get one free audio book and a one-month trial of the service, plus great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. So once again, audibletrial.com/televised. Hear for yourself why audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. When we come back, our new black co-star, Rebecca Knox, right here in New York, after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradioandspeaker.com, 130 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Your home for January Jones, sharing success stories every week, various times, right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Welcome back to the Marvin Televised on this Friday afternoon, and welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Another great guest coming your way, and all you have to do to be involved in the action, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Also coming up this half hour, our classic trivia question of the week, and our first answer to our survey of what your favorite Price is Right pricing game is, apart from Plinko. And now joining us live here in New York, one of the newer co-stars of Orange is the New Black, going to its final season next year on Netflix, Rebecca Knox. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Very fine, thank you. And our last guest, Sean Kraft, had a lot of great things to say about your performance this past season.
Oh, that's an honor. That's so amazing to hear. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Tell us about yourself, about Orange is the New Black. What was it like being part of getting into the cast and getting into your character?
I got the audition for Tina Slope, and, you know, the description was that she's an oxy addict, and I've never taken that before, so I definitely had to do a lot of research, and that entailed going on YouTube, you know, reading interviews, just studying the effects mentally, physically on the body, and also the victims of, you know, the epidemic of the opioid crisis in this country, and so I did a lot of research before I stepped foot on set and did my first day of shooting. I thought that was really important. I wanted to do it justice. So, yeah. So, I mean, I did a ton of research before getting into it, just to really understand who Tina is.
And ever since your episodes have come out, particularly the last one, that's the one Sean really got knocked out by your performance, what kind of reaction have you heard, particularly from families or people that have been impacted by this opioid epidemic that is killing all sorts of people every year?
Yeah, well, I think in general, just the fact that it's really heavily tied in this season and obviously in the next season, I think overall, like, because at this point it is at its, you know, top, you know, breaking point in terms of how many overdoses there are a day, I think the show does an incredible job of representing those people, and especially the incarcerated women, you know, that's usually just so taboo. At least it's bringing it to the surface, and I think it's a beautiful thing that this show, this amazing show, Orange is the New Black, is taking that issue upon itself. So overall, what I've heard from, you know, people I know, you know, friends of friends, they're really happy and honored and excited that this topic is being discussed and becoming more, you know, at the forefront of, you know, discussions, you know, yeah.
When you came aboard Orange, what did Jenji Kohan, the creator, the other key people on her production team, but more importantly, the other actors who we've come to know over these last 5 or 6 years, what did they do to make you as comfortable as possible to bring out the best of your character?
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone on set is so nice. I definitely was nervous going into this huge set that's been around for, you know, so many seasons at this point. So my first day, everyone was really welcoming. Everyone introduced themselves and told me what they do. And I got a lot of thank yous, which I thought was crazy because all I wanted to say is, no, thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And the cast, too. I mean, what's so lovely about this cast and the crew is that it's just, it's not like anyone's the main focus point. The actors and the crew members are all working together, and there is no hierarchy. I mean, what I've experienced on other sets is, you know, there's like this really big separation between actors and crew members, and it, there's just no communication, and it just feels like two separate worlds, two separate groups of people. But what is great about the show is that everyone is working together, and I think that's the best kind of show I could possibly ask to work on. I love having that camaraderie.
You're hearing Rebecca Knox. She is one of the newest players on Orange is the New Black, which will be going into its final season on Netflix next year. And you can see the current and previous round of episodes right now on Netflix, available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices all over the place. And on some cable operators like Comcast's X1 systems as well. Rebecca joins me here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom and Applebaum will be live from New York. Glad you're with us. This 90 edition coming your way on this final Friday of October 2018. If you have a question or comment for Rebecca, make it go 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Don't forget, coming up on our program Monday, the former head of CNN, Jonathan Klein, will be joining us. He's got a brand new venture in the world of artificial intelligence and television. We'll also meet one of the key people working with him on this new venture. Plus, veteran TV observer David Tice has got a brand new book out called The Golden Box, which we will, starting next week, offer as a prize for our classic trivia question of the week. And we'll also have popular CNNnews.com correspondent Joan Salzman, who's here in New York. We'll talk to her about what Apple may or may not say about Apple TV next Tuesday at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and a whole lot more. How did the road to Orange is the New Black come your way?
How did what?
The road to getting the part on Orange is the New Black. How did
Oh, yeah. Well, just the regular old audition process that, you know, we all of us actors, you know how it goes. I got actually called in for a couple other characters on the show before I got the call to audition for Tina Swope. And I guess third time was a charm because that's the third time is when I booked it. But, you know, it was just a standard audition. They send you a script in advance and they give you like a day to prepare and then you just go in and do it. Yeah.
Is this the first time you've had a regular role on a television series?
Yes, it is, and it is so exciting. I cannot wait to do more, bigger, bigger, better, everything. I'm just hungry, and it just showed me what I want, you know, in the future, what I strive for. It's a great show.
Yeah. So given this is your first role in a television series, is there something special about your performance that you decided I'm going to emphasize? And let's say you wouldn't have if you came to this from other TV shows you did, whether it was as a guest shot or as a recurring basis.
Well, I think, you know, being that this is my first bigger role, I knew from the get-go that this is my moment. You know, someone believes in me and someone's giving me this opportunity. And, you know, this group of people are giving me this opportunity, so I'm going to go in and I'm going to be as prepared as possible. And I'm going to be kind to everyone and grateful every single day and just do my job well. And listen and act and have fun and just, you know, I never wanted to be a problem on set. So I just always went in with just a really positive attitude and it's really paid off because here I am in the next season and I've made some lifelong friends in the process, in the front of the camera and behind the camera. So, yeah.
Well, we'll get to the next season shortly. But first, one of the things that has made Orange is the New Black a very special program is that it was the first program that really you didn't know what you wanted to call it, whether you wanted to call it a comedy, whether you wanted to call it a drama, whether you wanted to call it a dramedy, or whether you wanted to call it slice of life. And I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, the Emmy Awards have been sort of semi-kind to Orange, and that's a whole other story. But I'm wondering, when you're out there performing this, and you have this kind of, you never know which way a storyline is going to go or which way an episode is going to go, how does that impact your performance and how does it impact everybody else's performance?
Well, I think, you know, definitely, you know, it's great that we have so many great directors on set that are giving us kind of like our feel for what our role is in the scene. I mean, usually what happens is, I think what's beautiful about the show is that it incorporates comedy and drama. And, you know, every character has their part in that. So, you know, if someone is more dramatic than, you know, someone else in the scene will probably have a more comedic, you know, line to just like even the playing field out. So, I mean, from my understanding so far with my character, she has been more of a comedic, you know, comedic part in the sense that she's just a dirty mouth, like she kind of acts like a 12-year-old, but then she is given these moments of, you know, drama and pain, and I think that's what's so beautiful about the writing, and I think all characters really get to experience that, and that's why I think it's such an accessible show in general. Because you have both. You don't have to just cry and sob, and there's no relief after that. There's always relief, and I think that's the beauty. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In developing your character, did you refer to anything in your life, or did you refer to anything, let's say, that you knew about from a friend?
Yeah. Well, I she doesn't speak like I do. She has a dirty mouth. So I think what she reminds me of is what I was like when I was, you know, like, 13 and 14, like attitude and like wanted to be part of the clique. You know, I wanted to fit in so badly that I just did like terrible little, you know, little girl things. So she definitely reminds me of that time of my life. So I definitely draw energetically from that. And in terms of, I mean, I guess I've kind of stolen some of my really good friends, you know, like body language things to like build this character. Cause she's definitely tougher than I think I am. I mean, I was nervous actually going into it because I was like, I don't know, like she speaks like this and she acts like this and she's gonna stab someone, like so I definitely pulled from different people in my life to kind of build this tougher, like tough cookie girl. Yeah,
when you throw in the opioid storyline, did you and your research get the chance to interview people who have been impacted by this? I've had the chance in different places to dive into this subject, and the more you get into the subject, the more you just see how horrific it is that pills have caused the death of so many people when there could have been treatments, had people been warned about the potency of these opioid products, and that there were ways that they could get around it, that maybe a lot of lives would have been saved.
Well, I didn't get to interview anyone, but I do I do have a few people in my life who have struggled with that kind of addiction. So it's definitely been helpful to to have access to people who, you know, are really affected by this problem. I mean, but what's great about the internet is that there's a plethora of information and, you know, people out there who are struggling, you know, who got addicted because they were prescribed and then they no longer had the prescription. And those pills, those medications are so, so strong and addicting. And the problem is that it's given out like candy. And then of course it turns into a problem. And there are a few brave people on YouTube who decide, to, you know, that I watched that, document their struggle, and that I found extremely helpful in understanding what it's like. I mean, there's plenty of information and brave people who even document, you know, their withdrawals and put it on YouTube, and it's most definitely not easy to watch, but it gave me a deeper understanding of what it's really like to be imprisoned by an addiction like that.
Yeah. By the way, if anyone's listening out there and you're dealing with this issue, keep in mind this, you can get help. It is not too late. There are resources in your area, but you have to communicate and encourage people to take fentanyl or whatever to get them off it. So don't suffer in silence, folks. If you or someone you know is dealing with this crisis, you are not alone and you have support out there. Reach out for it. Please do. It could be a lifesaver. Last week, Rebecca, Netflix announced that the next season of Orange next year will be the last season. How are you and the rest of the people taking it?
Well, I'm more so honored to just be able to have acted on two seasons of this incredible show. I think overall the general consensus is, you know, I think it was time. I can't really speak for the rest of the cast that's been there for season after season from the start. But, you know, I think the stories have been told, and although it would be beautiful to have it keep going, I think it's understandable, you know, it's time to move on from the characters and, you know, grow and see where else, you know, where else we can take that, those stories, and what kind of shows that can come out of it, whether it be spinoff shows. Who knows? There might be a spinoff show. I mean, I have no idea. But yeah, I think I'm just grateful to have been in two seasons. It's just an amazing show to be a part of, and I mean, that's just how it goes. Seven seasons.
Do you have an idea of how you would like your character to go, without giving too many spoilers, but any sense of where you hope your character goes in the final season?
Well, hopefully with a big bang. You know, some drama, some big-ass drama, some nice exit. I have no idea, but maybe she'll get out of jail. That'd be cool. Yeah, I mean, who knows? We'll see.
You know, hey, that may be a good idea. I mean, Jenny's mind has, like, as many of the prisons as possible. You get your chance to, you know, let's do a big Shawshank Redemption. Everybody gets out of jail. Everybody finds their new life, you know.
Yeah, you never know.
Unfortunately,
you know, life doesn't work that way, but we'll see what happens.
We will, and that, of course, will be next season, the final season next year of Orange and the New Black, available on Netflix. Of course, the current season is available right now. We have a smart TV set, a smart TV device. You can check on all of the seasons, including this current one of Orange and the New Black. Rebecca Knox is with us. She is the co-star. She's been with us, the show, for the last 2 years, and she's with me live here in New York on Smart TV Televised. Happy year aboard as we get ready for a weekend on this October of 2018. Tommy Applebaum with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment, Rebecca, don't be shy. Pick up the phone, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We have our Cracker Trivia question coming your way. Plus, we have our survey that we started earlier in the week of what your favorite Price is Right pricing game is, apart from Pleco. I know Pleco's number one, but what if number two is? And we already have an inquiry, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So while you're waiting to get the second, the final season of Orange started, are you looking at doing any other TV projects? What's up in terms of future work?
Yeah, well, I actually wrote my first screenplay. It's called Cavity, and I just filmed it. I funded it myself. I produced it, and I acted in it. And I got a really amazing group of New York City crew members involved and great actors. And we are finishing up our last day of editing this Sunday, and we're going to start submitting it to festivals, and then the plan is to write a feature-length screenplay from there, and I really love writing, so I really want to get my writing career off the ground as well. Yeah.
And what's the film about?
How did it come about?
What is the film about, and how did it come about? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, the film is actually based on a personal story. It's based on a relationship that I was in that was abusive. And I think in terms of the current climate, you know, and the Me Too movement, I think it's an important story to tell, even though it's definitely scary to be vulnerable like that and have people know a part of me that I don't usually share. But I was having coffee with a friend earlier this year, and, you know, I was talking about what happened, and she was like, wow, well, this sounds like a movie. And I was like, huh, yeah. So the seed was planted, and then I wrote a script, and then I wrote another script and a draft and another draft and another draft. And then 12 drafts later, I had it locked, and I got a crew together, and I filmed it in a weekend. It was a beautiful experience, cathartic for sure. It helped me process my experience.
At some point down the road, would you like to create your own television series, and not just create it, but produce it?
Oh, 100%. I take pride in the fact that I'm an entrepreneur and a producer, and I love to dip my hands in a lot of different buckets, I guess. I don't know if that's the saying, but I definitely would love to. I would absolutely love to write a TV show, maybe a sitcom, definitely some feature films. I have a lot of different ideas that I'm working with right now. So I definitely see that down the road.
And when do you and the rest of the Orange Gang go back for your final season, start filming again?
Oh, we started filming already, actually. We're filming right now, so we should be done by February if all goes well, and you should see the next season out on Netflix next summer.
Do you film here in New York, or do you film in Los Angeles?
We film here in New York at a few prisons and some studios.
Well, what studios do you film in?
Kaufman Astoria and Silver Cup, and then some local prisons around.
By the way, do you hear from actual prisoners? Do they see the show? And what, I'm curious what they think about it.
I personally have not heard from prisoners, but I do believe that the reception, from what I know, the reception is really good because it's the first time that, you know, incarcerated women are getting a voice, and, you know, there's more attention being placed on their situations and who they are. And I think this show paved the way for that. So I believe that the reception has been good. I can't fully 100% speak on specifics on that, but yeah, I think overall it's been a really great reception.
Well, no question that over these last few years, Orange has had tremendous reception among the audience of all over the place, and it's resulted in everything from critical acclaim, all sorts of awards, Emmys, Peabody's, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm delighted that we are going to get at least one more round of episodes with you and your fellow characters and your fellow inmates, if you will.
Yes.
Orange and New Black. Yeah, absolutely. The final season of Orange and New Black will be happening next year on Netflix, but don't wait until then to catch this amazing and groundbreaking show. You can catch it right now, all of the current seasons, and you can do that on your smart TV set or smart TV device. And for more details about the program online, you go to www.netflix.com. That's www.netflix.com. All of the seasons of Orange that have been already done, currently up, and the final season of Orange New Black probably late next spring, next summer. Rebecca Knox, co-star of Orange, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations to you, your fellow crew, Genji Cohen, the creator, and everybody involved for what has been an incredible run of one of what I think will go down as one of the truly groundbreaking, really ground-shattering television series in the history of the medium, and which is the very, very best in whatever you decide to do, film, television, whatever.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely talking to you today.
Same here, Rebecca. Take care. Have a fantastic weekend.
All right, you too. Have a good Halloween.
Will do. Rebecca Knox joining us live from New York. Once again, Orange New Black. Current season available now. Final season next year on Netflix. And now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. We're still waiting for an answer to it, and it's this. How many pricing games have The Price is Right presented in the course of its 40-something year run daytime on CBS? How many different pricing games have been played on The Price is Right in its run on CBS, current and previous? If you know the answer, email me, SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. It's SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. And if you're first with the correct answer, here's what you win. The DVD of the current season of Loudermilk, now running on the Audience Network, getting great reviews, by the way. Caesar Milan's Love My Pitbull, another CD courtesy of National Geographic Wild. And the John Edward 6-CD set of Developing Your Own Psychic Powers. That all can be yours. And all you got to do is email me, SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from. And if you're first to correct the answer, you win. If you missed the question a moment ago, don't worry. I'll post it tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. That's UBC Simon, TWBT. Remember, in order to win, you got to be in, so play, and all the very best. And in the meantime, we also want you to get involved in our first ever Tomorrow We Televised survey. What's your favorite Price is Right pricing game apart from Plinko? Yes, we know Plinko is number one, no question, but what is your favorite apart from that? Well, I'm happy to say we have our first answer. It's from Megan Bartolo. She Facebooked me with her choice, Cliffhanger. No question. That's the exact quote. Cliffhangers, no question. So please Facebook me, Twitter me, email me with your thoughts about what your favorite Price is Right pricing game is, apart from Plinko. We'll keep a running tally. I'll give you an update on Monday, and we'll give you a final cuddle of this unscientific poll on next Monday's episode. Once again, thank you to all of our guests, Dan Isabel Ray, Rebecca Nossum, Orange, and Sean Fouch from Lore for being with us on today's program. Wonderful 90 minutes to spend with them and all of you. And don't forget, coming up on our program on Monday, another 90-minute one in store for you. The former CNN president, John Klein, will be joining us talking about his brand-new artificial intelligence and TV venture. Then, famed TV observer David Tice, the author of the brand-new book, The Golden Box, will be joining us, and we will offer that prize very soon in our classic trivia contest. And finally, the popular CNNnews.com digital media correspondent, Joan Solzman, will join us. We'll talk about things happening in the world of smart TV sets and devices and how it's all playing out in the world of television programming. It's all coming up Monday, 3:30 Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. If you missed any of our program today or came in late, or you want to catch up on episodes you have previously mixed, we'll make it easy for you. Go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also listen to us in podcast form. It'll be up there in a couple moments on iTunes.com, the Apple TV or Spreaker podcast app, or at the iHeartRadio podcast network at www.iHeartRadio.com. Remember, in order to get us from iHeartRadio, go to that website, put Tomorrow Will Be Televised in the search bar, click it, and you get our episodes right then and there. We love hearing from you. What do you think about our program today? And, of course, what's your thoughts about where this medium is at and where it is headed? All you got to do is email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Again, that's how you get involved in our Craft Trivia Question of the Week. We also have a regular feature we'd like to get your input on. It's called The Show to Know. Is there a TV show you like that doesn't get enough attention? Well, we'll give it the attention, but you got to let us know. If we do, you get the credit. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget, you can find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's at UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, however you communicate with us, we appreciate it. I respond within 24 hours. Why? Because we're committed, you get heard, and because what you say matters all the time. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not only those of Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Our production associate here at Blog Talk Radio is Candace Williams. Andy Toth, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of this very enterprise are Al Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise is brought to you today by Audible.com, the product development partner of the New York Television Festival, and an Amazon company. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For a free audiobook or Audible theater presentation, as well as a one-month trial of the service, it's audibletrial.com/televise. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening again. Thank you to all of our guests, not just today, but all week long. And we hope you have a fantastic weekend ahead. We're back on Monday, another 90 edition coming your way to wrap up October. 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. And, of course, whatever you're doing this weekend, please make it safe and great. And keep those thoughts and prayers coming to all the people still being impacted by the residents of Hurricane Michael in the Florida Panhandle, Georgia, and elsewhere around the South. They will appreciate it very, very much to be a stand with them. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.